All right, here I am, guys. I am back, and we are up for episode 7 of The Human Occurrence. I'd first off like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of this land, past, present, and future. Our guest on the show today is Yvonne Donohoe, who is a very powerful woman. She is a teacher, a mother, a friend, a sister, and an author. She has written a book recently on grief. And how you can blossom from that experience. And we really dive deep into unexpected death and sudden death, and what that entailed for her, her family, and the Byron Bay community. So as always, guys, I feel this episode is going to be jam-packed full of value for people that are, you know, discovering death or are interested in it. So stay tuned, buckle up. Here we go. You know what, Lennox is, if I had the money, I'd buy there.
Yeah, it's really lovely.
It's beautiful.
It's taken me a long time to adjust to it because we lived in Byron for 30 years. So.
Right. And what do you mean by that? Do you mean like the community or just the
location? Yeah, just to feel like I belong. It's that sense of belonging.
Yeah.
But I feel, I know enough people here now. Like more and more Byron people are moving down, so.
Yeah, well, it's only like a 15-minute drive, right?
Oh, I spent a lot of time back in Byron anyway because the kids are all there still, so.
Yeah.
And it's funny because Byron's changing. I think that's what's tipped it. Like there was a long time when I'd go back to Suffolk and I'd miss Suffolk, but now it's so busy it's just not the Suffolk that I lived in anyway, so.
Yeah. No, look, I agree with you. I think that Byron is, it is changing rapidly. It's, I think it's kind of lost its sense of community in a lot of ways. You know, I've been up here for 15 years now. And, you know, in that time, as anyone would, they'd notice change. But the biggest thing for me has been in the last maybe 12 to 18 months is the sense of community that I once felt, which doesn't really feel like that now. You know, you've got the super rich coming in. You've got everyone that has all the answers, right? It's very unlikely that you could, you know, I just noticed that the other day walking down the streets of Byron, and I ran into some people, and they have an urge to, you know, especially death, right? They have an urge to, like, you know, tell you not just their view on things, but you know, what's wrong or how to heal it or how, you know, I just think it's a whole bunch of spiritual ego in a way, you know, it's like, I think a lot of people kind of just need to stay in their own lanes. And there's a lot of people there that are kind of not embodying what they're preaching, which is really interesting. It's just a funky town. It's a funky town, but.
I know. What do you do though?
What
do we do?
It's all a choice, right?
I've heard stories from the place where we always go and get our skin checks done about this time of the year. And there's people who've moved up and they've closed their books because they can't take on any more people. And the people are going, well, you know, why can't we take, we'll pay you more. Like they just want to, they think they can buy their way into every service.
Yeah.
And you go,
what? Yeah.
It's uncharted territory.
It's going to be really interesting to see where it heads toward, you know, next, you know, maybe 6 to 12 months, and what that looks like. But you know what, like
it might settle,
but with saying that, and like when I really feel into it, you know, I wasn't the same person 10 years ago, you know, and you were a lot different. And, you know, so it's kind of like, you know, do you, you know, waste your energy, you know, going, oh God, what it used to be, or you just move with the change or move
That's
out
right.
or move out, go yeah. to Lennox, get a nice a sea view in Lennox, like you. Hey,
create a new community somewhere.
Yeah, that's right. How's your day?
It's been busy. They're all busy at the moment, but it's winding down, which is great.
Yeah. So tell me, you're a teacher.
I'm a teacher. Well, I was a teacher and then I wasn't a teacher. And then when COVID hit, I was really lucky to, because we were really impacted by that. Just,
yeah.
Through, we had a rental property in Byron, and the girls that were in there all lost their jobs, so they couldn't pay any money. And then we had like a commercial property and they weren't trading, and it was just like, anyway, it was really good. I was given some work at this gorgeous little school, and it was just fantastic.
Yeah. So,
not a lot of work, but just enough.
Yeah. And what do you teach, like primary school, or do you teach high school?
Primary.
Right.
Primary. Yeah. Kinder to six.
Right. And what got you into that?
Oh, gosh. I just left school and went to teachers' college. I've taught, I've had a 40 year career.
Wow. That's that's four long service leaves, right?
I know. I was the principal at Mullum Public School when Ben was killed.
Wow.
Well, and I just couldn't do my job anymore. It was too hard. So I retired early because I thought, you know, most people would just keep taking leave. But I just thought, I'm never going to be able to do this job properly. And so I retired, and then, like, I don't know, 5 years later, I went, oh, right, I'm back. I am. I felt well enough then, like emotionally and psychologically well enough. But it was too late then. I could not go back into the school. So
And you.
But then I had to recreate myself.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's a big part of post-traumatic transformation, right? So
yeah,
I studied a bit of that, and it was like such a light bulb moment for myself, because when you go through and I really, you know, learnt about the gifts that come from death, right? And how one can change their identity like completely. And it really resonated with me because, you know, I had an interest in death, dying and loss for about 5 years before mum died. And I studied a lot about that. But, you know, the transformation for me has been quite incredible in so many different aspects. And I guess you could relate to that, right? Is that your...
Absolutely.
How did you transform from Ben's passing, like looking at it now?
Well, I went on a spiritual journey that mirrored my grief journey. I say it was like a complex dance, you know, just this interplay of the grief and my spiritual journey. So that was a really huge change for me. That was a big thing. And then realized was that my grief was wound driven. It was being driven by unresolved wounding, like early childhood wounding. Right, so I had my grief for Ben, but I also had this other unhealed grief.
Great,
and it was just like a gestalt. It was attaching, and it wasn't until I healed from the early grief that I could then start to heal my grief for Ben.
That's so fascinating.
Yeah,
it's like opening up in a worms in a way. Like you understand, and you get, you know, the access if you are willing enough to actually look at those wounds. And I think
that's exactly right.
And I think more people need to really dig deep in that, especially men. Men are quite wounded, like from the wounded boy, and hurt, and there's a lot of healing that needs to be done with men. But so what I want to talk to you, could you so it's 10 years, right? 10 years in February 16th, right, since Ben passed.
It's July.
Ben
was born in
All right,
so 10 years last July.
Right.
So
right.
almost not 10 and 5 months.
Right. And he was 20?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Starting out, you know, like just hitting his straps as he...
Just hitting his straps. So could you take me through the moments of when you did find out that Ben passed and what actually did happen?
So we lived in Suffolk near the beach, and I was at the beach when the police came to tell us. And it was like really early Sunday morning, because he'd been killed Saturday night, like early in the morning.
Right.
So what had happened was, he was actually living on the Gold Coast, and he was a uni student. He was doing sports science, and he used to work casually for a local caterer, Jeff Butler. I don't know if you know Jeff Butler.
No, I don't.
Anyway, Jeff and Karen have a catering business. So they'd asked Tom and Ben to work that on the Saturday night.
Right, right.
So Benny drove down from the Gold Coast to work the wedding. It was a wedding. And Tom had driven out, and Tom, when the wedding finished, so it was after midnight when, you know, they, by the time they packed up, or maybe it must have been a bit before, because he dropped into town, Tom dropped him off in town. So then I've got a third son, Maddie, who was living in Sydney with Dylan Garth. Do you know Dylan?
I don't know. I'm terrible at names.
Anyway, Dylan had come up for the weekend because he was a Byron boy. Anyway, Benny and Dylan just ran into each other in town, and they'd heard that there was a party on Bangalore Road. So they said, let's go and check that out, which they did. And it was a bit lame, so they just said, and Ben was tired, they just said, oh, let's just go home. So they went out onto the street hoping to get a lift, because by that time they thought, oh, people will be finishing work, you know. And if they couldn't get a lift, they were going to catch a taxi. So yeah. What happened was, while all this is happening, so Ben's story kind of starts 12 months beforehand, because the young man who was driving that caused the crash, he had been at a wake all day for a mate of his that had died 12 months before. Right. So he was in a bad state. He was upset. He was angry. And apparently he'd come from, so that day he'd borrowed a car. So he didn't have a car.
Right.
So he borrowed a car.
Yeah.
And he went to this wake all day. He'd been drinking. He'd been kicked out of the Northern, apparently. He went out to a mate's place at Sunrise. And then apparently just before, so while the boys were at a party, he's at Sunrise, and then he leaves Sunrise to go back to Suffolk Park. He came through town, and apparently he drove through town so fast. He was airborne when he went across the speed bump at the post office, and the taxi drivers saw him, and they actually were radioing each other saying, get off the road, or watch out, be careful, there's a guy coming through town, he's angry, he's driving like a mad person. So while that's happening, the boys are deciding that they'll go and try and get a lift, and if they can't get a lift, then they'll call a taxi. So just as they walked down on the street, it coincided with that guy coming through where they were on Bangalore Road, and he just pulled over, and they just jumped in thinking that it was just going to be a normal ride to Suffolk.
Yeah.
And Dylan got in the front seat, and Benny was practically still climbing in the back seat when the guy took off. So he just didn't even give him a chance to get in. He didn't have his seatbelt on. When the policewoman told me that, I was so angry. I said, well, he was foolish. And she said, no, he didn't get a chance to put it on. So luckily Dylan survived. So he's our link between the great unknown. We didn't know we didn't know this fellow. Tom knew him because Tom had gone to school with him, but he wasn't in anyone's friendship circle. Anyway, when Dylan got in the front seat, the guy looked at him, and he just did this. These are Dylan's words. Dylan said he just looked at him and he said, in a demonic voice, buckle up, boys, and took off.
Wow.
And Dylan said he just put his foot on the accelerator and just didn't take it off the accelerator. And Dylan, I think Dylan said at first he thought he was just showing off, and then he realized that there was something really wrong. And he said to the guy, hey, mate, slow down. Now, the boys were only in the car for about 20 seconds and he lost control and hit a tree. Hit the tree near where, you know, the roadhouse is.
The roadhouse. Yeah. I know the spot. Yeah.
So that's all happened in the early hours of the morning and I didn't even know. So when I got up to go to the beach, Benny's room, we had friends staying and they were in Ben's room. So I'd made a bed up downstairs for Ben. And when I went to the beach, the bed hadn't been slept in. And I kind of thought, you know what? I didn't even think anything could be wrong. I just thought, oh, he's stayed with Tom or he's met up with a friend and he's just stayed with a friend. It wasn't a big deal to me. I just thought, you know, he was a young man, he was independent. So then when I came home from the beach, my husband Mick said, oh, the police had been, and I went, oh, have they? Like, still in this whole world of naive ignorance, you know, that something could happen. And he said, yeah, they were asking about Graham, who's my ex-husband, and he's the dad of all the children. And I just thought, oh, he must be sick or something, because he travelled a lot. He was, you know, he travelled a lot. And I thought, oh, something's happened to him. And Graham's and Mick said, oh, they said they'll be back soon. Anyway, within minutes they'd arrived and they got out of their police van and there were two of them, a woman and a man. And, you know, I just greeted them with this sort of ignorance of, like, not in my deepest, wildest dreams would I think anything had happened to any of our kids. And, you know, she kind of just fished for a minute or two. She was just making sure I was the person she needed to deliver the message to.
Yeah.
And then within a minute, she turned the conversation around and asked me if I had boys. And I just knew straight away then that something had happened. And it was like my heart just started racing and I thought, oh, my God, this something's happened and this is not going to be good. And she said, there's been an accident. And she said, three boys involved. And straight away I'm thinking, Tom and Ben were together last night. And then she just said, Ben's been killed. And I just went, it was just like, it's so hard to explain how you feel in that instant. Because there's the whole trauma, you know, my body just shut down. It was just like, I don't know. It's such a traumatic thing that you can't even process it. And so it was like, you know, I obviously, like, my body started to shut down. She got me and she took me and sat me down. And then she sort of said, you know, is there anyone we can get? And I just went, I'll get Tom. He'll know what to do. Because it was like, I just didn't know what to do. I just had no idea. And it was just like, it's so hard to put it into words, but just, you know, it was just like my brain just filled up with fog.
You couldn't comprehend it. Like,
no, you can't. You can't. It's a trauma and it can't be processed in real time. It has to be, you have to have time. And it was just like, yeah, it was crazy. You don't even know. Like, there's something happens to the synapses. You can't even form sentences. Like, you know, it's not like you would sit down and have a rational conversation like this.
I
just said to her, yeah, get Tom. He'll, and it was like, because Tom was at a board riders comp down. Because when I was at the beach, one of his mates had said to me, oh, you're going to go down to board riders. And I'd looked down the beach and I'd seen the tents set up. And I went, no. I said, no, I can't get there today, because I always went to church of a Sunday morning. Like, that was my routine. I worked full time. I went to church. I said to him, no, but I'll go and watch Benny play football this afternoon, because it was a home game and I always tried to get to the home game. So it was just like this, I don't know, you can't even prepare for it. Even if you know you've got someone in the family who's going to die, or pass, like you obviously, you know, your mum wasn't well, but it's still that moment of sort of separation where it's just, or finality, it's that final
moment. But I just, I nearly think that you can't really compare sudden to expected, because expected is that your body and your mind and your spirit can somewhat prepare for that moment where sudden is like what we're doing now, and then whack, someone's died. And it's just like you said, you can't, your body can't process it. And it's really interesting to hear how the police woman delivered the news, because in the study I've done, there's a lot of modules on how to deliver news like that, and to how to set that up, because the shock's going to be the shock. You can't remove that, but you can put in gentle steps, making sure someone's seated, they've got people around them. There's certain steps that you can take. So the impact is still going to be the impact, but it is a tad gentler. So, I wonder if that was the first time for her to do that, and obviously...
She was seasoned. She'd done it. I think she'd done it before.
Right.
And it's funny. I think it was a protective strategy for her. Like, imagine that. And that was one of the things I said to her while we were waiting for Tom, like Mick, my husband Mick, and the policeman went to get Tom. And when they came back, like while they were gone, I just said to her, I felt sorry for her for having to do that, like deliver that sort of a message to a parent. So straight away, I don't know, that was one of the things I remember saying. I don't think there was much conversation, but I did have empathy for her for having to do that job.
Mm.
Like I was a school principal. The only thing I ever had to do was suspend kids. Like I never had to make a phone call where I said, sorry, Mrs. Smith, but your child died today.
Yeah.
Like I couldn't even comprehend delivering that message.
Mm. Oh, it'd be yeah. You can only imagine, right? Until you do it. Like that'd be really, really, really tough.
We're good friends now too, by the way. I'm really good friends with her now. We've stayed really good friends. She's she's tough. But I think you have to be in that, because they had crash investigators who were investigating the crash. She wasn't the crash investigator, but she was at the scene all through on the night. They went through two lots of crash investigators before she ended up taking it over. Those guys just they had to take leave. Like they were constantly going to horrific scenes.
Right, yeah.
And in the end, she took over. She took over the investigation because they had to go on leave. And not just because of Ben, but because that's what they were doing day in, day out.
Yeah.
Or whenever there was a bad accident around this area.
Mm.
So it's, you think about workplace health and safety. It's a hard gig. That's a really hard
That's a really hard industry,
Absolutely.
In terms of protecting your mental health. Like how does that actually happen? With when you're such confronting things day to day.
One thing she said to me was, she said, look, she believed that when your time was up, your time was up. Now, for a newly bereaved mother, that was a really hard thing for me to hear. And there were so many things that were really hard that I heard over the coming months and years.
Mm.
But now I would probably, now I've got a different philosophy.
Mm.
But like you said before, there are certainly ways to deliver your philosophy or deliver your message.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. That's right.
You've got to wait till people are ready.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Oh. And it's so when you after you got the news of Ben, what was the process for you and your family from hearing that news to the ceremony?
Well, most of that week is a blur for me.
Yeah.
But we had to go and identify him. And I said to her, is he at the police station? I didn't know. Like, I wasn't familiar with the process of death. Mm-hmm. And she said, no, he's at the hospital. And, that just triggered a whole, like all my kids were born at Byron Hospital. And it was just a horrible thing to have to then go back to the scene of a birth to then view a body. So we, it took us a little while because we had to start telling people, like we had to let his siblings know that he'd, what had happened. And I think in actual fact, I was delaying going there. I didn't want to go and see him. I didn't want, and I said to her, you know, is he okay? Does he look okay? Or is he, you know, all broken? And she said, no, no, he looks fine. But see, she didn't know him. She didn't have that, a picture of what he would look like. And so we went into the hospital and this whole, it was just surreal. It was surreal driving into the hospital. I remember calling my cousin on the way in while we were going in to tell her, because my mum, like my mum was in her 80s.
Right.
And she lived at Kanellabar. And so I couldn't call her. I couldn't tell her. And I, that was one thing I was really dreading, that she would find out. Maddie was in Sydney. I had to tell him. I rang his work. He's a chef. I rang his work and I said to them, I'm about to ring Matt. And I told them what I was going to have to tell him. And I said, he's going to have to come home straight away. Like I wanted to do the back end of stuff for him. So I was obviously thinking clearly enough, but see, I'd gone straight into the mother role. Like when I had to do the mother role, I was okay. But then when I didn't have to do that, then I'd kind of go back into the, you know, the like spaced out grieving role.
Yeah.
So I rang Matt's girlfriend and I said, told her what had happened. I actually told her before I told him, because I said to her, they'd recently split up because she was Swedish and she'd been home for Christmas. And when she came back from Sweden, she said, I can't not be Swedish. I have to be Swedish. And she was in halfway through a course in Sydney. She was doing a 2-year course. So they sort of split up, but they were still together sort of thing. But he wasn't living with her anymore. He was actually living with Dylan, who was in the accident.
Right, right.
So I rang her. Yeah, I rang her and I said to her, you've got to go. I told her what happened. And I said, you've got to go right now around to Maddie because I'm about to ring him and tell him, and you need to be with him. So she was there. The work, his work was amazing. They organized the flight, they did everything to get him home. While he was at the airport, he heard that Dylan had been in an accident, and that's when, see, at that stage we didn't know that Dylan was in the car. We didn't know.
Right.
I didn't know who, I didn't know the driver, I didn't know who. She didn't give me any of that info, which was probably good. I wouldn't have been able to process it. So Maddie heard that Dylan was in a really bad accident and he was in hospital. And then it was two and two together. It was the same accident that had killed Ben. So we're driving into hospital. I rang my cousin because she lived in Byron and I just needed her to come. We were after the hospital, we were going to go. We actually had to drive past where the accident happened. And which is interesting, I call it an accident. Normally I just call it a crash because I don't believe it was an accident on many levels, but that's another thing to talk about. But so she was on her way out at Ewingsdale, her and her husband, and they just came straight back. So they were at the tree. We call it the tree because that's what the car hit, the tree.
Yeah.
So we had to go to the hospital. So there was my husband and I and a neighbour across the road and who, you know, had a lot to do with Ben as he grew up, and Tom. And you know, we got to the door of this little room where Ben was in and none of us wanted to go in. It was just like standing there, getting the courage pretty much to go in, because I knew once we walked into that room and saw him, it would be sealed. Like our fates were going to be sealed because it was true. Because up until then you think, oh, they've made a mistake, it's not him. Anyway, when we got close, when we walked over to him, you know, like we shuffled over just and he's there, and I looked at this body lying there, and it was, you know, his face was swollen and it didn't look like Ben to me, and I just said to Tom, it's not him. And I went, and I thought this relief came through my body. I thought, oh God, they've made a mistake, it's not Ben. And then Tom just went, it is mum. You know, it was so sad. Like he just goes, yeah, it is mum. And because when Tom got back from the beach, I thought that Mick and the policeman would have told him. And when he drove in, he didn't know. And he said, what's happened? What's going on? And I went, oh, my God, I've got to tell Tom. And it was just, that was the hardest thing, like just telling the kids.
Because
I loved, you know, like I was a single mum for a long time and Ben was the baby and they just adored their little brother and they helped raise him and, you know, even Tom, that was Tom's little, it was so funny. Tom goes, I practically raised that boy, you know, like, yeah, sure. But, you know, though we're a really close family. It was just like wrong, so wrong that there were four and then all of a sudden there were three and you just go, this is so wrong. Anyway, after we'd been to the hospital, because the policewoman, she was saying to me, she rang me because she went, she left us and then she said, will you go and identify him? Yeah, yeah, we'll go. And then I was stalling and she rang and she said, will you come soon? And she's told me just recently that she, not begged, but she talked them into taking him to Byron. They were meant to take him to Lismore. And she said to them, because, you know, they were up. The accident happened at 3 a.m. She came. We found out it was 7 or 7.30 when she came to, when I found out. So then it was like another hour and these guys had been working all night. They just wanted to get him to Lismore and, you know, finish off. And she said she really had, you know, she talked to them and said, this is a local family. Can you just please take him to Byron? And so that was really kind. So even though she'd been quite, not abrupt, but quite, you know, this is what had happened.
Yeah.
Behind the scenes, she'd done a lot of stuff to support us. And that was one of the things that I didn't even know she'd done. I just, you know, you just assume, oh, yeah, well, then he's gone to the local hospital, then he goes to Lismore. Anyway, on the way, after we'd been to see him and identify him, we then went to the tree and it was just like, just more and more people came as the word spread, just, you know, more and more people just coming and sitting on the verge, on the footpath, just none of us knowing. We're all processing, like everybody had to start processing this news of Ben being such a vibrant, you know, he was just such a nice boy. He was so vibrant and just, you know, it's just hard when you've lived in a community for like a long time. His dad and I went to Byron in the late 70s. So we've been involved in a lot of community groups, sporting groups, heaps of groups, the church, schools. So, and when you've got four kids, it was just like these four branches of people who knew about it and people just coming and just sitting with us and just everybody just not knowing how to process. It's terrible. Because as you would know, it's just time. You have to actually let time pass.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. And I, you know, I remember that so vividly because, as you know, I didn't know Ben, I knew Tom. But I remember so many things that hit home to me about that, how Ben passed. And I remember people mourning at the tree. And I used to, I'd drive past it and have such a sense of stillness and sadness when I was driving past it. But I remember I remember too that something so powerful for me, Yvonne, was his ceremony. And I remember that the invite went out and like it was inviting the community to be there. And I thought to myself, oh, I didn't know him, and you know, but I just really wanted to be there. And I remember going there, and that was the first time in my Byron experience that I felt the family of Byron, the community of Byron. And it just really moved me in a way that it just, you can't put words on that. There's something that speaks to you, your internal world, that there's a voice there that speaks to you. And that's what really spoke to me when I was, when I was at Red Devils and playing witness to people's sorrow, you know, because, you know, I didn't know Ben, I didn't have a relationship with Ben, but it brought me so much closer to that community. And you know, and I also want to acknowledge too is that, you know, the process that what you just brought me through with you know, witnessing Ben's body, that takes such a fucking crazy amount of courage. That like that with and in moments like that, and I can't compare to that because each death is subjective depending if it's sudden or expected, but I can only imagine, you know, what that would be like. I can't feel it, but that takes so much courage, Yvonne. And so I just really want to acknowledge that, because I think that people underestimate what they're capable of. And I think that having a bird's eye view on it now, you know, obviously in that moment, you wouldn't realize how much courage you had, but I would guess now that you can really reflect on it and go, holy shit, that took a lot, you know, but you did it together. You did it as a unit. And that's really, really special.
And one of the things, what you've just expressed about the community, that, like, when you asked before, you know, you grow and what are the gifts from something that's so horrendous, the gift for us was just that love from the community. You know, I'd always felt really like I belonged to my own community, even though I wasn't a local. You know, I had to live there for 30 years before you were a local, but all my kids are locals. They're all born in Byron, and the sense of community was so overwhelmingly strong. It's, I believe that's one of the things that got me through. Like, one day I was driving through Byron and the traffic was just banked up, not like it is nowadays, but it was just near where the news agency is, or between the post office and the news agency. Heading like north. So I'm driving down Johnson Street, and this is crazy. I was just in the car and I looked over and there was a guy on the footpath, sort of on outside one of the shops, and he saw me and I was stopped, and he just came over and my window was down and he just climbed in the car and gave me a hug. He didn't say a word, just he looked at me, and that look that I'd been getting from people all the time, it's just that look of sort of shared disbelief, just that look. And he just gave me the biggest hug, and so I just sat there and I just had my eyes closed, and because I learned to value the hug. It was just like, it says a million words, you know, you don't have to say a thing, but it just, it expresses so much. Anyway, when he pulled away from me, I looked ahead in the car and the traffic had moved on. And there were all these cars behind, and I reflected and I thought, oh my God, they either knew it was me in my car and they knew how much I needed that hug, or it was someone thinking, this could only happen in Byron Bay.
But that's...
But it was just beautiful.
And that's, like you said, that's the gifts, right? That's the gifts.
Yeah, it was a gift.
You know, one
look, we had people, like, it was a bit like, you know, the five fishes and the two loaves and the five fishes or whatever, where we had, because Ben was so young, and those kids, all his school friends, like, they think they're invincible. They had the double portion of shock. Because how could this even happen? And Ben was so vibrant. How could it happen to someone like Ben? And so every day for lunch, for not dinner so much, but definitely for lunch, we would have a house full of people, because that coffin, you know, like Benny's coffin, that was customized by all his friends and our family. So that was there for a few days, and they would come and just work on it. And so there were people around, and like, not once did I prepare a meal. Like, I didn't prepare a meal, yet we were like feeding the 5,000, but it was just people would come and there was so much food. And the caterer that I mentioned earlier on, he brought a cool room and put up in our garage so that we could put food in there so it wouldn't spoil or go to waste.
Wow.
And one day I could smell this aroma, and I'm just kind of going, what's that? And he's put a lamb on a spit in the driveway, and you know, he just fed us. Like, I think he may have felt like a bit responsible because Ben had been working for him. Not that it was anything to do with him. And even like the young guy that had got married, he was a local boy, and he'd requested Tom and Ben to work that night. So it was just like all these little ripples of people thinking, oh, and then the young guy who lent the car to the boy who was driving, like his mother, I talked to her and it was a little ripple of, if he hadn't have lent the car, you know, like this wouldn't have happened. And just so many, it's like a massive jigsaw puzzle, the whole, just that event. Like, because one of the taxi, like, interestingly enough, there, you know, I told you they were radioing. The guy, he hit that tree. So he'd accelerate. Dylan reckons, because Dylan was sitting there next to him. Dylan reckons that speedo was up over, like, 120. It was over that speed. The police did not, they said, I forget what the official record was. It was over 100, but not, like, Dylan was sort of going, it was up 120, 30. He was just booming. And he hit the tree with such force, the motor flew out of the car and flew over a taxi that was coming back into town, like just missed it. So it was like, you know, it was just crazy. A few years later, I was giving talks. I was talks to the high, at the high school for the year 11 kids who, it was part of their driving course, their safe driving course. And that was it was an interesting gig. And I wanted to do it because I wanted them to see that, you know, how quickly life can change in an instant. Don't get into cars with strangers, you know, be careful, you're going to be driving. And I would always have to follow this woman from the SES, like this, I think she was SES, and she would just show these batteries of videos of accidents, car accidents that was so horrific. It was almost like the kids, it was just like watching a movie, you know, that you knew it was just this fake movie, and all the kids would sort of start to switch off with it. And then I would get up and I'd go, okay, we've all watched that. And it's so easy just to go that it's a movie. It doesn't happen. I go, and then I go, I'm here to connect your head with your heart and tell you that it actually can happen. Anyway, I'd do a little story and have a PowerPoint of Ben and tell them a bit about what happened and tell them some yarns, because this is at Byron High. And he was a bit of a, you know, he was a bit of a trickster. I don't know if you remember, one of his teachers got up and spoke at the service, and Mr. Galloway, and he's kind of a short guy. And one time Ben made this thing like, you know how you have at Dreamworld where you have the ride, you're not allowed to go on the ride for a certain height.
Right, yeah.
And he put up this thing outside the classroom that you couldn't come in if you went over this height, and the teacher wasn't over the height. So it was like, they were the sort of things that he'd do. So I could share those kind of stories and help them to connect with him and see how, you know, you just, you can't, you've got to enjoy life, but you just can't be complacent with your life. Anyway, after one of the times I talked, two of the kids came up to me crying after the talk, and they both were kids of taxi drivers. And they said, we know what you're talking about because our dads were working that night. And just that, you know, just that's another ripple, just all this, so many people in our community that shared in the horror of what happened.
And how was it for you to be talking in front of teenagers? And
I it was good. It was good. Yeah. I mean, I'm a teacher, so it was easy for me to do that. Yeah. And I loved, I kind of would go into a zone of detachment. I worked out how to do that.
Right.
Because
right.
Another thing that I did was I ended up doing some things called circle sentencing. I don't know. Have you heard of that?
I haven't, no.
So a circle sentence is, it's taken, they took it from like Indigenous communities where they do that. They will get the community around to talk about the impact of what someone's done. Then they will all decide what the, not so much punishment, it's a restorative justice, like, so what you would have to do to restore what you've done.
Yeah.
So the New South Wales judicial system uses it. I don't know if they still are, but I was invited to do it as a victim's representative, and I did 20 of these circle sentencing sessions, and they were all drink drivers. So they were all drink drivers. They'd been charged, but there was no actual victim. So they'd been charged, but they hadn't, they might have caused an accident, but not, no one had been hurt or you know, killed. So I went in as a victim's representative, and you sit around a circle, someone chairs it, And there was always like at 3 o'clock, the offender sat and I was at 9 o'clock facing them.
Right.
And then in between, there'd be their family members or whoever was their support person. There'd be a police officer. There'd be maybe an ambulance officer or SES worker. And often there'd be someone from Alcoholics Anonymous.
Yeah.
So they'd have to tell what the story. They'd have to share what they'd done. And then I would share what had happened to Ben and how that impacted our lives. And then I would say to them, and I'd kind of go there, I wanted to be angry with them, but I never could be. I would just always have compassion for these people who were just, you know, obviously their lives, something terrible had gone on in their lives, and they were drinking to
numb it,
to cope, numb it down. Anyway, I was doing those too as well. And it was, I thought it would be really hard, but I just kind of move into this zone of detachment. And I would also think every time I share Ben's story, if I save one other person from having to go through what we went through and one other person from, you know, having their life ended by a drunk driver, then it's worth doing.
Worth it.
And and I'd always give them a photo, that little photo of Ben that I sent you, you know, I emailed through. I would always take one of those and I'd write a message on the back of it for them, and I'd give my number and I'd say, if you ever want someone to help you, because what we do as part of the circle sentencing, you come up with a plan for them, a plan where they can restore, give back to the community. And that plan goes with them back to court, to the magistrate. And if the magistrate accepts the plan, then they're not given a custodial sentence. But if the plan's not accepted, then they would have a custodial sentence. So it was really, you know, like we had to, it took hours. You'd be doing it for 2 or 3 hours because it had to be rigorous. Anyway, I'd always give them a card and say, you know, good luck. And if you need anyone to talk to, you know, I'd be more than happy to talk to you and support you. Anyway, twice I got phone calls. Once from a guy who said it was his 5 years was up and he was allowed to drive again, and he wanted to talk to me about whether he should go for his license. And anyway, I met with him, we had coffee and we became friends, and he said to me, he said, I've got Ben's photo on my fridge and I look at him every day and he inspires me. And so that was, you know, as a parent who is an activist, not that that was much of an activism, but, you know, I take inspiration from people like Lucy Haslam, who fought for, you know, medicinal marijuana because Dan, her son, had cancer, and Rosie Batty, people like that who are, you know, social activists. The guy who's the lad's fellow, that's terrible, I've forgotten his name because I know I've spoken to him. You know, the four boys that were killed out along Broken Head Road.
Oh, yeah.
That was terrible. So the dad of one of those boys, Robert Wells, he's done the lads program, which is teaching kids safe driving skills. You know, you go into it because you want to make a difference because of your child. You don't want their death to be in vain. So you think, and I think that's what just helped me get through being able to talk about what happened to Ben.
Did you, before all of this, Yvonne, and this is kind of what's dropped in for me, is that did you always know that you're a healer in that way? In, you know, because it seems like the work you're doing, and I don't know really how to describe it, right? But hey, look at the same bottles. Oh, you can't see mine.
Oh, nice. Does yours have a little yellow brick road?
No, mine just says refill and reuse.
All right.
But yeah, I don't really know how to describe it. But for me, hearing, you know, you really talk into Ben and your experience, is that, you know, you're quite a healer, and you're quite, but I don't think that really justifies that skill set there, but it really seems like that you're such a great example, and you're not like you said, like, you know, Ben didn't die in vain, but you're taking his death and you're turning it, you're flipping it, and inspiring other people. And those ripples that you keep talking about are so powerful. They are so powerful. These talks you're doing in front of, you know, teenagers to adults, to kids, all this sort of stuff. You only need to be, you know, really hit home with a couple of people. And then those people reflect that, you know, and then maybe a couple other people will reflect that again, and it gets passed on.
Exactly. Yeah. That's all I ever hoped, that it would make a difference for, you know, especially the teenagers, but then for these people who, I don't know, sadly, like some of them passed away, which is sad because they just were so sick. They could not recover from their alcoholism. One night I got a phone call from this woman, and she said to me, our brother just died recently and we're here packing up his gear. And he had a photo. She said, we found a photo with your name on it. And I'm thinking, old boyfriends? Was this an old boyfriend who's got a photo with my name on it? And then it suddenly dawned on me, and it was one of the participants. And he was obviously, you know, he was so sick. And they said to me, so the mother was there, and she remembered because she'd been to the circle sentencing session. Yeah. As his support person, and then she was there with the two daughters, and they said the fact that he had kept that and it was still in his belongings meant that it was obviously significant to him. I didn't hear from him, but that was such nice feedback. Like, it was just good to get that. Like, I just thought, oh, that's good. So, you know, who knows how that impacted him, but he kept it. So that was cool. Yeah.
So I hear that you've written a book.
I have written a book,
Tell me about it. What's it called?
Okay, so I've written a book. I've got a little picture. I had a picture here of its cover. It's not completely the cover, but it's going to be like there's hands holding a heart that's cracked open and a little shoot growing out the front, because it's called Soul Stripped Bare.
Right.
And then the subtitle is Growing Through Grief.
Amazing.
So it's all about being cracked open, but then there's growth that comes from the being cracked open.
Yeah. And
so it should be out soon. Like, it's with the publishers now, and it should be, I'm expecting them to send me the final copy any minute. So
was it a process of you... obviously it's a reflection on your journey, but were you documenting stuff along the way, or did you just have a light bulb moment where you were just like, okay, and you just, you know, started writing? How did it express? How did it come out?
Both of those. So right. I'm a writer. I mean, I'm a writer, not as in a professional writer. I just love to write. And so I was capturing, just diarizing. I just would write diary entries. And I'd make up little poems and just try to process. It was just all part of my processing. Anyway, a lot of very strange things happened to us, like quite mystical things that I couldn't understand, or, you know, I was just, Ben's death just opened me up to a whole new world of existence.
Right.
Like, I just feel like our brains are so limited, they're not limited, but we limit them, and we kind of box things in. And I think being cracked open, I was open to anything. I just wanted to know, like, where was Ben? What was he doing? Like, I just felt he wasn't dead. He was physically dead, but I knew that, like, he was, like, I know I keep saying he's so vibrant, but he was. And you just go, you can't kill that. Like, you know, energy can't be killed. And I'm going, so where is he? And then I would start getting all these messages from just a whole range of messages. It was like, and that's where the spiritual journey kicked in, because I'd been raised up in, you know, a church background, and I always said I'm spiritual, not religious. But you can't be part of a church and not be religious. And the problem was, I was experiencing things that went against what I'd been taught. And I'm going, how do I reconcile these two big things? Yeah. So here I was, I completely opened myself up to anything that the real, the physical world or the metaphysical world wanted to share or show me. And because of that, just the most astounding things happened right from the first day, like right from day one. And not even when I was consciously wanting that to happen, but it just did. Because Benny ended up in the garden of some matriarchs of the town who were very, 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 very spiritual ladies. Like, and I knew the family, but I didn't know them. Mm. And we went in, like we sat at the tree for a while, and then I don't know, I can't remember whether someone said, you want to go and meet these ladies? And because they'd lived through the horror too. And one of them was quite old, like really in her 90s, or she was old, and her daughter, it was a mother-daughter duo. Mm. And the daughter, she just said to me, Ben's with Jesus. And I just went, she said, we've been praying for him and I know he's with Jesus. And she didn't know me. She didn't know that I was actually spiritual and that that would give me a lot of comfort. Just to hear that gave me so much comfort. Anyway, I looked at her car and her rear windscreen was shattered. And so what had happened, he'd mounted the gutter, hit the tree, spun around and ended up in her driveway. And meanwhile, Ben had been thrown from the car. They didn't even know Ben was there. So the driver was injured and Dylan was badly injured because he copped the tree. He copped the brunt of the tree. Right. So the driver was trying to leave the scene, but he was injured too and he wasn't successful in doing that. Ben's in the garden and they don't know. And so they're they're working on Dylan and the driver. And then Dylan says to them, where's Ben? And the police, they go, who? And Dylan goes, Ben. Ben was in the car. And they didn't even know. So Ben's in the garden.
Wow.
And there was a young doctor that this is one of the things I'd love to do. I have not caught up with him, but the policewoman told me that he was on the scene and I would love to catch up with him. But she said he kept going over to Ben just to see if there was anything he could do for him, but there was nothing that he could do for him. But he wanted me to know that he was trying, you know, he went to see and if there was anything. I think by the time they realized that Ben was even in the garden that it was too late. But then I saw her car. So the car that was involved with the crash had gone. And then I saw her car and the windscreen was shattered and I said to her, did he hit your car? I thought he must have spun around, come into the driveway and crashed into her car. She said, no, he didn't hit the car at all. And I went, oh, I said, what happened? And she looked at me and she just said, do you know what I think happened? And I went, no, tell me. And she said, I think there were angels around. And she said, I think there was an angel in the driveway. And it just, so if I put my arms out, you won't be able to see, but she sort of went like a traffic cop. And she just went, and I think that, she believed that the angel just went enough and went like that. And the force stopped his car and shattered her windscreen. Like that was her take on it. And like, here I am, I've just been told my son is dead and I'm going, whoa. It was like, okay. So right from that moment was like, I'm thinking there's more to what's happened here than Ben just being in the wrong place at the wrong time. Like, I didn't know the details of any of the driving. I didn't know any of that at that stage. But once all those details became known to me, I'm just thinking, like, if I was a movie director, I could not have choreographed that act, like what happened. Just those boys. Apparently there was a girl at the party who had said to everyone, I'm doing a Suffo run out to Suffolk, if anyone wants a lift. The boys didn't hear her because Ben was outside talking to his girlfriend who lived in Melbourne and he said, I'm really tired, I just want to go home. And now those words, like, if I ever hear anyone go, I just want to go home, I go, be careful what you say, because like, to me now, our home is actually on the other side. And I'm thinking Ben went home. And just the fact that it was all put in play 12 months beforehand, like the whole thing was set in motion at least 12 months when that guy's mate passed away. Anyway, it just went on from there. Like, you know, anyway, it's all in the book. You can read it in the book, but just the most incredible
thing.
Yeah, I'll gift you a copy. I'd love you to have a copy of it. But like on the second day or the third day, Ebony, my daughter, oh, so there's a daughter too. So there's three boys and there's a girl, Ebony. She just said to me, she said, I saw Ben. And she said, I said, oh, what? And she said, yeah, he was sitting on the end of your bed.
When was
it? And I went about 2 days after he was killed.
Wow.
So he visited us. So the second day, I just said to the kids, I said, we want to watch out for Ben's totem. And I don't know anything about this stuff, but I was trying to grab at straws of, you know, how do we do this? Mm. And I said to them, you need to look out for Ben's totem. And they said, well, what will it be? I said, I'm not sure. It'll be some sort of an animal or something. And anyway, a little bit later, I was in the kitchen and the kids all yelled out. They went, Mom, Ben's totem's here. And I thought they were just being silly. And I said, what is it? And they said, it's a seagull. And I went out. They were all on our deck. We were in a two-story house in Brandon Street in Suffolk. And I went out and here was this little seagull. Now, we'd lived there for like 25 years and we had never once had a seagull at our house, not once. And here's this little seagull and he was on the road, or she was on the road and looking left and right and then walking because Ben's car was in the front yard because he'd driven down from the coast. So here's this little seagull walking towards his car and it'd take a few steps and then it would look left and right and then take a few more and it'd look up at everyone on the deck. And we just thought it was a bit funny. And my girlfriend was there and her partner had suicided like about 18 months before. So she'd been on that journey of learning and understanding. And she just whispered in my ear, she said, it's Ben's spirit. And he's confused because he doesn't know why he can't be with us. He can see everyone on the deck, but he can't understand why he can't be with you. Mm. And I just went, oh, my God, like, okay. And she said to me, have you got any hot chips? And I went, it's like 9 in the morning. No, we haven't got hot chips. And I said, oh, I've got corn chips in the pantry.
Yeah.
I just raced to the pantry and got the corn chips and I just raced downstairs and I sat at the back of the car. And I just fed this seagull. It came up to me and I was just feeding it. And I'm just looking at it. It was like, I go, this is the first sign of mother madness. Like, here I am sitting at the back of his car talking to this bird. Because what if it was? What if Ben's spirit? Because I'm thinking he was just thrown out of that car.
Mm.
It would have been such a shock to his whole body, all aspects of his body and his spirit. And I'm going, he's been thrown from this car. What if he's just imagine, like, we were in shock. Imagine the shock for him.
He would have been in, yeah.
So I'm going, yeah, so what if he is in this bird? And so I was just talking to this bird like it was Ben. I'm going, oh, you look fine, you know, like just trying to placate the bird in case it was Ben and he was listening. And I'm going, you're going to be fine. We're all going to be okay. We can do this, you know, just like as if your kid comes home and they've had a bad day at school and you're just going, it's okay. You're going to do this. You'll be able to do this. And it's funny because in the book I say that letting Ben leave, which some people don't understand, they go, how do you mean letting him leave? And I go, well, you can hold on to them and not let them actually leave. But I go, letting Ben leave was like, this is the analogy that I came up with, was like birthing him into the next stage of his eternal journey.
Wow.
Like, yeah. I had to just, yeah.
Mm.
And by looking at it that way, it wasn't an end. It was the start of something new for him.
Mm.
And was the growth for me, just not looking at our lives like, you know, the dash between the birth date and the death date, but looking at in this eternal continuum that we just, you know, life, I had to honor his, even though it hurt like hell and it was terrible. And it took me it took me a good 7 years to really surrender to that. But once I did, I felt okay about it because then it was never ever a case of Ben just being in the wrong place at the wrong time, but it was just him honoring his eternal like his soul development. It was for the next stage. But anyway, here, so then I had the seagull. And then the next day, Ebony says, I saw Ben. And he's sitting on the edge of your bed. And I'm going, what do you mean? And I said, what did he look like? And she said he was all silver and shimmery.
Wow.
And he was sort of sitting there and he had his hand, like she said, it was like the thinker pose, because our bedroom like opened up to the deck. And she said he was just sitting there with his hands, like his elbows on his legs and his hands in his head in his hands. And he was just looking out the window. And I went, oh my God. Mm. And I said, did you say anything? She said, no, I didn't know what to do. Mm. And it's all these things where you just go, when it's your first experience, you don't know what to do.
Mm.
So she just watched him. Yeah.
That doesn't sound mad to me at all. When you were describing how you were talking to the seagull, and obviously seeing Ben's spirit on the bed, that to me makes complete sense. And
yeah.
You know, I'd like to mention too, is that as humans, for some reason, from my experience, like to learn the hard way, but we live majority of the time, not all of us, but a lot of the time, until we have a really significant experience or something happens where we drop into our body, we do live in our heads a bit. Yeah. So the mind wants to work things out, you know, like that this wall has got a picture on it. It has to have an answer for everything. And when you described to me about the seagull and also how Ben died, right, and the shock with that, you know, it would not surprise me at all of him having a process in himself where he's also confused, going, okay, hang on, have I actually passed? You know,
that
because I really believe from whatever your beliefs are, from heaven to wherever you return to, there is a transit spot in between where we are now and that, not end, the beginning of the next phase for us. And I think that you can get stuck in there. And I think with real sudden deaths that the soul or spirit or source or whatever you want to call it can kind of get stuck. And it makes complete sense to me, Yvonne, that you were talking to Ben and that was maybe maybe he got like permission or he understood or he kind of dropped in and went, okay, I can go now or I can transition now.
I know it was all amazing. And there were so many things that happened like that. And because I was trying to go, am I creating this stuff? Or because there's a fine line between wanting to, not create a story, but to in that what you're saying, like your brain's trying to process it. So was I creating things?
It's trying to work it out.
But so much of it was from outside coming to me, like later at the service at the Red Devil's Park, when we all went out and made the big guard of honor across the field, the two ladies whose house the car had ended up in were sitting there, and I knew they wouldn't come out to that guard of honor. I wouldn't see them, so I went over to thank them for coming. Because, you know, they didn't have to come. It was horrific for them too to go through that.
Mm.
So I went to thank them and then everyone else has moved out and I turned around and a friend of mine was just standing in front of me, like between me and where I had to go. And I looked at her and she said, oh, look, I've been trying to avoid doing this. And she said, but I just can't. I keep getting told to give you that I've got to give you this. And I went, and I was like, it was sort of this crazy moment where I'm going, I could see beyond her and they've got Ben and they're about to walk him across and I'm thinking, I'm his mother, I'm supposed to be there. Mm. And she was, I mean, it took a lot of guts for her to do this and it was her window of opportunity to actually do this. And she's standing there and I looked down and she's got this little gauze bag in her hand and I could see through it and as a little heart, a diamond, like a diamond encrusted little heart. And she said, I've been told to give you this. And I went, oh, okay. I said, who by? And she goes, you know, and she looked up, she's like going like that up. And I'm going, no. And she goes, you know, and she's looking up and she said, I've been told to give you this. And so she'd already prefaced it by saying, I try to ignore it, but I can't because I keep getting this message. She said, I was told to give you this and to say, thanks, Mum.
Wow.
And I'm going, so here's like this week and I'm just going, oh my God. Like if, and this is part of the thing where you know, there's societal expectations where societally I was expected to be out there to walk my son across the field. And I wanted to do that too. Like that's what I wanted to do. But I also wanted to grab her and go, let's sit down and make a cup of tea and tell me all about this. I want to know, how did you get the message? Who told you? So I'm walking. So I just hugged her and thanked her. And I walked out and like had to run to catch up to the sort of the procession. And I'm walking across the field going, oh my God, was that a message from God? And then I'm going, no, God wouldn't say thanks, Mum. And then I'm going, that's a message from Ben. And I'm going, how can he, like, here he is, like, he's supposed to be dead. And he's on the end of my bed. You know, it was just like, honestly, it was like, how could my brain sort this all out?
And that's when your brain gets fried. Because your brain can't comprehend. It's not designed to actually get this sort of stuff because it's not logic. It's not black and white. It's not a calculation. No. This is coming from a heart space. And that's one of the biggest gifts of my life from death, that it has brought me straight into my heart. And it's got me out of my head. And once you know death, you can't unknow it. It's just like, it's a switch that gets turned on and that switch is forever on. And you change from that. And there's so many beautiful things that happen from it and how close you come to the one that has died. I could never
comprehend. In a way that you can't in the physical. Like you go into a different relationship with them that's hard to explain. But I think that time, and this is what I write about a lot in the book, that I just wanted the pain to end at first. I just wanted the pain to end. But then by the end of what I write about is what a gift grief is. It's just such a gift. Like those first minutes, hours, days, months after someone passes, the veil between this world and the next is so thin. And I just felt such closeness to the other side. It was just, you know, like synchronicity was incredible. Things that just happened, it was unbelievable, just synchronistic events. And they went long after that too. I remember it was probably about six weeks. It took me a long time to go back to church, and then this was my spiritual journey where I ended up not going to church at all. But it's not that I don't have a faith. I still do. I have an incredible faith, but I describe it in the book as it's like the way I can only explain it is like someone who goes on a journey. So you set off. You set off from one point and you travel around the world and you come back to that same point, but you're on a different level, a bit like the departure and the arrivals halls. You know, you left from the same spot and I've come back, but I am so on a different plane now. And that's been my growth. But what was I going to say? I went back to church. It was so painful. I'd be up the back listening to these songs that I'd sung because I love singing, and I was in the choir and I'd sing, but I'd be at the back of the church and there'd be just tears streaming down my eyes and thinking, this is just too painful, because we'd sing a song like, he gives and takes away, he gives and takes away. And I'm going, until you've had something taken from you, you can't possibly understand what the implications of those words. Mm. Anyway, after church, we'd always go out for a cup of tea out the back. And, you know, like I was standing in this circle of these older women and they're going, how are you going, dear? You know, like, I go, you know, try to make small talk when I didn't want to do small talk. Like from the moment Ben was killed and I thought, I'm not into small talk anymore. I'm into big talk. I want to know where he is and what he's doing and how And I thought, okay, you've got to say something. So I got really good at having two conversations at once. There'd be the one I'd be having in the physical and then this one that's happening in my head. And I'd be going, right, you've got to say something. You know, they've asked you a question. You've got to say something. So I'd go, you know what? As a mother, all I want to know is that Ben didn't suffer. And so their response to that, one of them tapped me on the, like patted me. And she said, well, dear, he's not suffering now. And I thought, you know what? You just missed the whole point of what I just said. So I grabbed my friend and like within minutes we'd left and I had to go to Woolies to pick up a few things. Like I just said to my friend, and on the way from the church, which is in town, to Woolies, I had told her what had happened. I said, I just said, you know, I want to know that he didn't suffer. And they'd sort of given me this platitude. And I just said, you want to scream at people and go, no, but did he suffer? I want to know. Did he suffer? Anyway, I went in to Woolies and grabbed like about three things. And I came through the checkout. And as I was walking out the doors, this is old Woolies, the big double doors opened. And one of the mums from my school walked in. Now, her kids had started school that year, at the start of the year, and she was a new paramedic that had come up from Grafton.
Yeah.
And she just looked at me and she just grabbed me and hugged me and she just whispered in my ear, she said, if there's anything you want to know about that night, anything at all, just ask me. She said, I know. And I looked at her and I just said, I just want to know that he didn't suffer. And she said, he wouldn't have felt a thing. And I just went, oh, my God, I've just asked that question at church and I couldn't get the answer. And then I truly did feel like God had sent me the person that could answer that question. And I'm getting shivers now because this is the sort of stuff where I go, to me, I just go, even though I felt I was so disappointed that God had let Ben get killed, I know the whole time I was being held in grace and I was being looked after and on all levels. And that was one of the levels. Like for her, the synchronicity of her to walk into that supermarket just as I was leaving and to grab me and to say, if there's anything you want to know, anything at all, just ask. I know. And I looked at her and I said, were you working that night? That's right. I looked at her and I said, were you working that night? And she said, no, but I know. Because, you know, they'd talk.
Yeah.
And for her to answer that question, and, you know, that was the first answer to that question I received. The next year when I went back to work, I took the rest of the year off. I didn't go back to school. I went back the next year and it was Easter and we're making Easter basket, like all the eggs, you know, for the big Easter raffle. And so sitting in the staff room and there were about 10 parents at the start and then one by one they all had to go. And in the end there was myself and one of the mums. And look, the conversation just took this really weird turn. All of a sudden, she just started telling me how she died. Like she'd been dead for 10 minutes or something, or not 10 minutes, but she'd been dead for a long time because she'd had an allergic reaction to something. And then when she came out of it, she had these spiritual powers. And honestly, she's a gorgeous woman, not at all sort of, I don't know, you know how you just think, oh, yeah, okay. But she was not like that. She was the most unassuming person. Like for these words to come out of her mouth, it was like the biggest shock to me. And then she started telling me what happened, the accident. Because I said, look, I don't know what I was saying to her because it was just the two of us in the staff room. And then she came around to where we were sitting on opposite sides of this big table, staff room table, and she came around, she got my phone, and she's using it like a toy car, and she's showing me exactly what happened. And I'm going, wow, okay. It's like just another one of those situations where, like, societally, I was the principal and I couldn't be sitting in the staff room having that sort of conversation when all I wanted to do was just call a holiday and send all the kids home so I could just sit there and go, tell me more. I want to know more. And then when she left, she hugged me and then she said to me, Ben's telling me that if you're feeling sad or you're down or something, and she went like this. She said, he's saying to do this. And I thought she meant my heart, like just he's in my heart. And I mirrored what she was doing. And I normally have, but they're not on at the moment, but I normally have three little, like not trinkets, but three little charms, which represent my love, hope, faith. And they were all given to me. The love was that little diamante heart given that day. That night, girlfriends of mine that had come up from Sydney, one of their daughters had given a little cross for her mum to give to me. And that was the faith. And the hope, another girlfriend, after the seagull story got out, she gifted me a little silver seagull. I wear them together, and they're my love, hope, faith charms. And the story behind that, the backstory, is Ben, before he died, had bought his girlfriend a little love, hope, faith charm for her 21st, and he never got the chance to give it to her. And this is one of the saddest things. Like, his mates had to give that little charm to her on behalf of Ben. Like, he was such a nice boy. He would have gone home. Like, most guys would have gone, oh, I'm wrapping this up. I can just imagine that he would have gone home and he would have been saying, look what I bought, Like, he would have been just so proud of that little thing that he was going to give her. So, and then when I got those three little charms, I went, okay, this is my love, hope, faith charm. And so when I did that, because I had a shirt on, she didn't know what I was wearing. And then when I went that, I felt them, the little charms. And she said, Ben's saying, when you're feeling down, just do this. And there they were, these little three charms. And I'm going, and then, so that was, so I've had car, she's showing me what happened. Then she says that, and then she's standing in front of me and she said, there's someone behind you. Now, we were the only two in that staff room. And she says, someone's standing behind you. And it was like one of those moments where I just go, I didn't know what to say to her. So I said nothing. And I went, wow. So I had some kind of etheric body behind me. I don't know who it was. Because I was just too, when you're caught off guard, now I can go, oh, I should have said this and I should have asked her that and I should have asked this. And I was just like,
but you
so
know,
I went back into my office and just went, oh my God.
It's hard to, though, Yvonne, like when such magic is happening. How are you meant to name it? Afterwards you come up and go, oh shit, I should have said this or, that or this. But words are not needed in that. It's all feeling. And what you were, transmuting between each other, that's the magic, not words or anything like that. And that's such special, it's really, really special things that have played out for you. In that,
and how did the book come about? One of the things too was I kind of got a message that I had to write the book. I didn't sit down to write a book. I was given the message that I had to share all of these, what I've learned and all the experiences.
Yeah.
And I do believe a lot of the book's inspired. If someone asked me now, this is great that we're having this conversation, but if someone asked me now what's it like to lose a child, I could probably describe it in a few sentences and that would be it. Whereas I've written a 600-page book. Yeah. It's a manual. It's a grief. It's a memoir come manual on the experience of that sort of the whole death experience and then the grief experience and then the healing experience. And I had to, because when I got this message that I had to write the book, I'm going, oh my gosh, I had written a lot of stuff, but it was all over the place. It was on post-its and on notes and on my phone. And so that was what took so long, because I had to pull it all together and try and put it into some kind of readable format and some kind of, like, trying to work out, do I do it chronologically? Do I do it in, that was the hard part. That took a long time to do that. And so, you know, I'd be chained to the computer just trying to make sense of how this book was going to come. But I just kept putting it out there going, okay, you guys want this book. You have to help me.
Show me,
show me. And, But I write for the collective. That's what I say. I write, you know, I'm lucky. I love literacy and I love language and I love to write. And I'm writing for all those people who can't express what they've been through. And so, you know, I'm hoping there's a book that if they need to give to someone to say, you know, this is what grief's like. I can't put it in words. Because I go into the research. I actually go into the research on grief, which I didn't plan to do.
But
I kind of did. But what I wanted initially was I invited other people to share their story, because I thought, look, my story is one story, but there's so many stories. So I started approaching friends who'd lost kids. It's all mainly, it's parental grief. It's about losing a child. So I invited all these, and unfortunately, sadly, like, I know quite a few people who had lost children. So I asked them one by one, you know, would you be able to write something for the book? 12 months went past and no one got back to me. And I went, oh my gosh, what am I going to put in this book? So then I got into the research and I'm thinking, this will be simple. This will be a piece of cake. I'm going to read a few research articles. I'll critique them and just put them in the book. Well, that was like opening up a can of worms. Honestly, the research was like, I wanted to know what was normal grief, because I wanted to know that I was normal, like, because I was feeling very unnormal, feeling like I was actually mad. And now I just go, well, of course, you have to go mad a little bit. Like, you can't process such a shocking, traumatic, like, news of the death of your child without actually going a little bit mad. And then I go into brain research and how, you know, our body shuts down to protect us. So all that's in there. But
yeah.
So here I had, and at first I was angry with the research because I realized I was a statistic. Ben was a statistic and I didn't want him just to be a number. I wanted him to be like this living person who now had moved on to something, you know, better, I hoped. But he was a statistic and I was a statistic. And so I had to get past that. I had to move past my you know, I wasn't enjoying what I was reading, because I was finding out, like, according to the research, anyone who is grieves for longer than 18 months, they go, you're a complicated, you know, you've got complicated grief. But then as I delved into the research, it was the cohorts were basically widowers, elderly widowers, and, or not elderly necessarily, but a lot of them were, and they weren't longitudinal studies necessarily. So,
right.
Yeah, and so I just go, I took it upon myself to become a longitudinal study on grief. Like, now I'm still learning about it. Here's 10 and a half years, I'm still learning about grief. But I actually go, I don't agree with that, because all of these parents that I'm interviewing, and, like, the good story is I've got, like, 15 people in the book. They all came back one by one. They said, oh, no, we want to write for the book. And I'm going, oh, God, that's why it's so big.
Yeah.
Because then I couldn't not put the research in either then. I had to share what I was learning, because, you know, I learned so much about grief. So it was like, okay, I'm putting it in. But I went through the process of thinking, I want to cut it back, because it's actually not as saleable. Like, it's too big. It can't go into a bookshop, because it's not, like, it's not going to, you know how they want to make money. Like, basically, it won't make any money. But I need to have this book. I'll probably sell it through my website, because I need it to be affordable. And that can't happen if it goes into a bookshop. But I'm not worried, because I know it's meant to be out there. It'll get into the hands of, it will definitely get into the hands of the people it's meant to get into. So I'm not worried about that.
Have you thought about putting it as an audio book?
It would take a long time to read because it's a lengthy book, but I could do chapter by chapter.
I'll invite you to think this way, though, is that this day and age, more and more people are reading less and they're on audio books. So why audio books are so popular is basically because you can put it on in your car, you can put it on when you're you can put it on anything. Yeah. But Yvonne, the reach that you can get through an audiobook is nearly triple what you can get out of put into a bookshop. So you should definitely do both because I reckon you'd be, people need to be getting a hold of this, and it's just like, you know what it's like. It's like letters are going out of fashion now. You know, who sends a letter, but letters are so significant, and so special and put a lot of history with them. So books will always be around, but audiobooks are huge, massive. So I'd invite you to research that because, I want a copy of it. I would
give you a copy because I think it would be really handy for what you're doing. Just to as a reference book as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. The other question I had for you was, have you ever considered systemizing your experiences with grief and actually working with people through that?
Well, I now am also a life coach. So yes, I will. But I don't, it's funny, I work with people on careers and relationships, but I haven't yet because I haven't promoted. People don't know that I exist in terms of that realm, but I'm definitely, once the book's
why is that?
Once the book's up and running, why is it? I don't know. I just haven't, I'm not sure why. I don't know. And I know I should be.
You just need to get out of the way. need to get out of the way. I think you're incredible, and I think that you're a really good teacher. So and I think that what I've got a sense of is obviously you've got a real passion for grief and your experience with that, and you're so valuable because you've got 10 years of that journey. I'd really support you in considering that because that's there is a lot of life coaches, right? There's a lot of people doing life coaches, but who the hell is walking beside people in grief? And who is, you've got so many different things that you've gone through that would resonate with so many different people and would not necessarily have the intention to fast track their journey, but give them the tools to unravel their own grief, their own internal world. Yeah. And that's a gift. So I'll be on your case. I'll be on your case.
And I'll think, thanks, Brett.
You need to be doing that because...
I do it informally. Like I'll send, there's a lady on Facebook that I support with just messages. Like I do support people, but very informally, just with a little message here or a message there, but not formally.
Anyway, I'm planting that seed.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, no, that's great. No, that's good. It's so funny because I'm a coach. And so this has only been new because I had to retire. Like I couldn't do my job anymore. I went back for that year and then I went back part of the next year. And, it was like the defining moment, this is quite a funny story, but the two conversations that was, I had a mother in my office and her child, she was whinging because her child had lost his lunchbox. And I was sitting there and there's this voice in my head going, do not yell at her. Do not yell at her. I wanted to go, I've lost my fucking son. Do you think I give a rat's ass about your kid's lunchbox? And I'm going, so here's his voice going, you've had a really good career. Don't wreck it by just losing the plot now, So here I'm going, oh, that's terrible. We'll do this. We'll put all these things in place, So your kid who can't manage his own lunchbox. And I, when she left, I went, that's it. I can't do this anymore. I can't sit here and pretend that I care about the things that I should care about as a principal, you know? I mean, lunchbox is pretty trivial, but I can't, you know, I had such a good staff and I had great people like executives supporting me. You know, I'd get a phone call from one of my assistant principals going, are you coming? And I go, where am I meant to be? And she go, we're at the meeting. And I go, where are you? And she go, in the library. And I would have called a meeting that I'd forgotten about.
Right.
Like I just was not, you know, and I was, and I loved my job and I was so, you know, I'm not saying I was so great as being a principal, but I gave it 100%.
Mm.
I gave it 100%. That's what I did give. And then, but once this had happened, I couldn't give 100% anymore because my whole, you know, why am I on this planet shifted. Mm. I wanted to know more about life and death and life after death. And I wanted to know, that was where my priorities lied then. Well, it was about the big questions.
The switch, like we talked about, the switch had been turned off. There is no turning the switch off. And
you can't turn back. No.
There you have
Absolutely,
it.
Absolutely, you can't.
You, I think you're incredible. And I think that voice that you keep referencing, I think that voice needs a microphone. And I think that is, you know, that needs to be your internal compass because I really do hope that that you do something like that because that's where your gifts are at. And you know what, there's a sense of joy. There's a sense of passion within that with you that I can feel. That new realm. So
it's interesting because when I healed, so here I was, I gave up my job. Like most people would just not do that. They wouldn't retire, they would just take leave. But I just was so convinced that it wasn't my path anymore.
Mm.
So I gave up my job, like relinquished my position, retired. And then I was writing the book, so that kept me occupied. But once I healed, I thought, well, what am I going to do now? Mm. Like, I can't just, I don't know, my brain's too active. I couldn't just do nothing. So I actually then trained to be a coach. So that was 2017. And so I've been dabbling in that. But, like, I could never nail down my niche. Like, what is my niche? Because they go, you've got to have a niche. And I'm going, well, I don't know. I think because I've had quite a lot of experience, like life experience. So, you know, I've done quite a bit of career coaching and I do relationship coaching, as I said.
Mm.
But the grief coaching, I don't know why. I think because I do respect that process that I feel like one of the things they do at coaching school is they do this grief bust and I go, no, that's so wrong. You don't try and bust someone's grief to get rid of it. Like you just... It's a process. You need to sit with that. And I'm going, I'm just trying to reconcile how you coach. Like I recommend counselling and, I think if you're stuck, you need to have counselling. Mm. But, coaching, I've just got to see that I have to feel in my heart that it is something that I do believe what I could do, like that I could help people.
Mm.
You know, if it's a career, I've got this thing about taking money from people who are grieving too. Like I just think, so I'd probably have to do it all pro bono because I just think you were already hurting.
Mm.
You shouldn't have to pay for support.
I get that, but I also disagree with it because I feel like there has to be some exchange. There has to be some exchange.
Yeah.
I talked to, I don't know if you know Zenith Virago, but she's a local educator.
I know Zenith, yeah.
Yeah. And it's a similar situation with her, right? Is that, you know, she works with the dying and people through bereavement and all that. And it's the same transaction with that. But what you've like, I guess, you know, you've got to take away your mind and, you know, what your perception is of, you know, a transaction, but what you're offering is something so valuable. And I think Yvonne, I think you just need to get out of your way because you are so there. And I can nearly guarantee you this: you could study life coaching, you could study relationship coaching, you could study, and it's going to be the same answer because you've already got the answers. You are already that coach. The training began when Ben died.
And here you are now.
So like we've been talking.
I just needed to hear that.
But like we've been talking about is like, get your brain out of it. Stop. Your brain is bringing in speed humps. So you don't get there, you know?
Yeah. And I don't know why. I need to reconnect.
That's what it's here to do. It's way more.
Oh, yeah.
It is designed. It is so intelligent. Our brain is so intelligent. And I'm a big believer in your brain is there to take you away from your heart. But it's whether or not you can actually, you know, synchronize them and understand, okay, hey, I'm not in my body. I'm in my head.
Yeah.
And when you're in your heart. But in terms of a transaction with grief and all that, people will pay that. Yeah. And it's just, you know, it's just probably, it's a tough one, right? It's like, when Zenith or when a death walker goes and walks beside someone who is dying and then charging them for that. Right. But it's a service. It's a service.
Yeah.
And we live in a world where, there has to be a transaction for what you're offering.
Yeah, I do agree with that.
You know, but it's the way we're conditioned. It's the way with going, okay, oh shit, you know, grief, death, you know, the perception of it's dark and evil and all this fucking crap that comes with it. It's all a load of shit, you know, and guiding someone on that journey through grief is one of the biggest things that you could do for somebody with that.
If you could fast track people to this moment of joy, like, you know, like of course you miss the person that you've lost, but I don't know, like, honestly, one of the big messages I kept getting from Ben was he did not want me to be sad, and that was a tough one because I needed to honor my own body as well. But having that conversation with someone, and I think because of the longevity of it now, I do know that people, like when you're first in there, you just can't possibly imagine that you're going to survive. And there were times when I had to make that choice. I'm thinking, do I want to be here or do I want to be with Ben? Because I'm his mum and I've been with him through all his other milestones. Do I join him now? And then I'd look and I've got three other kids here and I go, well, what message would that give them? You know, there are some tough decisions that you make, even though I don't think I ever would have done anything, but just thinking about it gave me comfort sometimes because I thought I could end this pain. But it'd be nice to be able to say to someone, it'll end, you know, it does pass. Doesn't mean that you don't love your child or the person that you've lost. Okay, well, I will seriously consider it. Thank you, Brent.
I'll be on your case. I will.
Okay.
You could just imagine, like, if you know, and it wouldn't imagine on your journey, you know, having someone that wasn't going to fast track it because they understand that time is so valuable, but just gives you tiny little tools along the way. And that's what I was so thankful for with Zenith and doing her course, is that I understood a lot about grief, dying and death and loss. And then by mum dying, I embodied that. And then I went through it and I kind of had the grid going, oh, okay, this is actually normal, how fucked up I feel, you know, or how, you know, crying for days, or, you know, being crippled by that pain is normal. You should consider doing one of her courses.
That's a good idea.
Absolutely. Because she ignites this sort of stuff.
That's a good idea to do one of the courses. Because sometimes I go, you know, like if I'm talking with someone, I do feel like I have an aptitude to take someone, let a conversation flow. Like I can perceive where they're at and what they need.
Yeah.
But it would be good to have a bit of a framework too about, you know, just
get in.
Like
get in.
I had to learn all that myself. I came up with my own grief milestones, and I came up with the things that helped me, like what, you know, a big turning point was like gratitude. Just, and you know, it's such a buzzword now, but it, like, you know, it was so easy for me to go, this is so unfair. Ben was only 20. And then I was interviewing women who got to hold their baby for 1 hour before it died. And I go, oh my God, how lucky were we to have 20 years? So it was like reframing and turning it around and going, I thought, well, how long would be enough? Would 25 have been enough? No. Would 30, 35, 40? No, none of it would ever have been enough. And my mother-in-law said to me, it doesn't matter how long you live, it's never enough. It's never long enough. And I thought, that's so true. So then I just went, I started practicing gratitude. And every time I felt a bit down, I went, you know what? We were so lucky to have that boy for 20 years. What a joy. What a gift he was in all of our lives for 20 years. So, and so it just, it that flipped a switch, you know, and that was one of the strategies that I used.
And it's made my life so rich. It's given me a newfound of presence, but you're right with gratitude, because I get that with mum. You know, everyone's like, oh gosh, she was 60. I'm like, she spent 60 years on this earth. I'm like, we were so fucking blessed to have her 60 years. I'm like, That's right. That is old. Life is too short. People bang on about that, but life is also too long not to do it well. You know,
so,
but it's, you know, I could talk to you about this all day, but I've got to, I do have to wrap it up. One thing I do just want to acknowledge before we do go is, I want to acknowledge your book, because that is, so it is such a powerful milestone. So I really, really hope that you're celebrating that in whatever way you celebrate that. But I also want to acknowledge your journey to get to the book and what that was like. So, like I said, I really hope that you're doing what you do with your, whatever, however you celebrate.
You'll have to come to the launch. Are you local? You're in Byron?
Yeah, yeah, I'm definitely coming to the launch.
The launch. That would be so good. Yeah, when it happens, I'm definitely launching it, because there are so many people I want to thank, because, you know, it was definitely a shared journey of grief. Like when we lost Ben, the town lost Ben, like the community lost Ben. So, and it was just so many people who went on that journey with us, and I know it's made such, like, it's impacted so many lives. Like his death was just so impactful.
Right. Well, I'm a great example for that. I didn't know Ben. I never met Ben, and it just like realigned me. And then from that, I had gifts from his death, and I realized that now. But when I was, you know, 10 years ago, when I was just, you know, a young, I was a boy then. I get it. But now I realize, and reflecting on that, I was just like, there's so many gifts from that. So I didn't know Ben, and I got that gift. So look at, that's amazing.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah.
All right. Well,
and thanks. Thanks.
Is that a wrap? Is that what they say?
That's a wrap. And, What I want to do is, number one, I want to get that book. I want to come to the launch, but I want to do this again with you.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I want to do this again, and I want to go further into, I want to dissect it a bit, and I want to go further, if you're open to it, further into the grief.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
And I want to, since we kind of touched on that new world that you're experiencing, so am I, I want to dive deeper into that.
Absolutely. I'd be honored to do that. It's so funny, because for years, you know, I would have any opportunity, I'd just be chewing someone's ear talking about all these sorts of things. Because to me, it was just like, you know, my what is it, the scales had dropped off, and I saw this new way of seeing life and death and life after death, the continuation of the spirit. And but, you know, I don't know what it is and why it is, but then I don't know, you can get caught up in just life, the busyness of life, and yeah, you just, it forgets to, I don't know, it's not that it's not a priority, but it just fits in there with everything else then, whereas before it was like this, whereas now it's just become a much smaller thing. I think because I was writing the book, I lived and breathed it for so long. My husband said to me, I can't wait to be a writer. He reckons he's going to write a book. He said, I just need to buy a new pair of pajamas. He saw me sitting around the house in my pajamas for so long.
That's amazing. Yeah. Hey, thanks again for coming on. And
my pleasure. Thank you. And, let's do it again. And good on you for doing what you're doing. It's amazing.
Thank you. What I'm going to do is I'm going to tag you in all this. And hopefully,
did you find me on Facebook?
I did. Yeah, I'm just waiting for a friend.
Oh, me. Oh, right. Okay. I don't go on very often, but I will go and have a look. Okay.
That's all right. I'll message you when I put it up. And I just think a lot of people are going to find so much value out of this. And hopefully, a lot of people from the community kind of check in and have a listen if they dare.
Well, thank you. Yeah. Do you get many people listening, tuning into the podcast? Look, I joined up, but I thought, like, when they come, do you get a notification that there's a new podcast?
No, you're just going to be online. You've got to see it online. Oh. Yeah. So you're kind of going to be an active kind of scroller. How many people, you know, I'd say maybe 50 people might listen to it. But there's, you know, this is what we're doing it for, right? This is what you're passionate about. This is what I'm passionate about, is changing the conversation around death. And it's not, it's not all dark and evil and all this crazy stuff as people perceive it to be. There's a lot of beauty and light in it.
Absolutely.
So that's my goal, is just to kind of spread that and change, you know, change the conversation around it slowly. And if it takes me the next 50 years, then whatever, I'll try.
Well, good on you. That's so good. Well, good on you. And, you know, it's your callings. That's beautiful. I think it's so nice to know what your purpose is in life. And that's fantastic.
Mm.
It's a great thing.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you. And I look forward to, I'll keep in touch with you. And
have a great,
I'll tell Tom we finally did this, because Tom keeps going, have you followed up? Have you, contacted him yet?
Yeah, no, I'll let Tom know as well. I love Tom.
Yeah, he's a gorgeous boy.
He is. He's great. He's a beautiful
family. Yeah. All right. Well, thanks, Brent.
Thanks
for love to you and your business and what you're doing. Okay.
Thank you.
See you. Bye.